Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Rayner.
And today we are so pleased to be joined by Morgan Cable. Thank you so much for being here, Morgan.
Hey, happy to be here.
You are a research scientist in astrobiology at NASA, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, isn't that right?
Correct.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do there?
All right. So as an astrobiologist, technically, I'm a chemist by training. To study astrobiology, you can actually come from many different backgrounds. We have some people who studied biology or chemistry. Other people study things like geology or even astrophysics. All of it is important for trying to understand our search for life as we know it or as we don't know it in the solar system and beyond. And so my job day to day involves sometimes doing experiments in the lab to try to get at that question, or getting involved in missions or mission concepts, things that haven't become missions yet, but we're hoping will one day, to try to look for that life.
So you look for life on other planets from a laboratory, essentially.
Yeah, that's one of the ways that we can get at this question. It's kind of hard because we still, just as a scientific community, can't all exactly agree on what the definition of life is. And since we only have a sample size of one, right, the life on Earth is the only life that we know of to exist so far. So we'll try to do some tests here to like test some theories of things that could be similar to life as we know it, or maybe are really wild and wacky and are sort of pushing the bounds of what we think life could be somewhere else.
I noticed that you're wearing a Firefly shirt. Dragonfly. That's the Titan, right? Is that the Titan mission?
Yes. So Dragonfly is a mission that was recently selected by NASA through a program called New Frontiers. And I am so excited. I'm a co-investigator on that mission, which means I'm on the science team. And so as one of the scientists, I will get to work with the Dragonfly team as we build this spacecraft. And then once we get to Titan, which is Saturn's largest moon, I will get to help analyze that data and hopefully write some really fantastic papers, because we're going to hopefully learn a ton of amazing things about this fascinating moon.
Oh, that's like a helicopter or something like that? Is it a rotor on Titan?
Yes, Dragonfly actually is an 8-bladed helicopter. So if you picture like your standard kind of quadcopter drone that people have that they can fly around in their backyards, take that, make it about the size of a car, so like the size of the big Mars rovers, and then instead of the 4 blades, now add a second one underneath. So it's got like 4 sets of kind of paired blades that rotate in opposite directions. That helps with like stability of the rotor craft is what we call it. And this is going to launch in 2026, and it's going to arrive in the Saturn system and land on Titan in 2034. Yes, space is big. It takes a while to get there. And it's going to have all sorts of instruments to be able to understand everything from like if there are Titan quakes, we'll have a seismometer to be able to sense those. We're going to have a sampling system that'll grab some of the surface and pull it in to Dragonfly inside the spacecraft, basically to test, taste, and look for some organic molecules. Everything from like small organics to complicated things that might indicate if there ever has been life there or could be in the future, if it's prebiotic is the way we like to describe it. So it's going to be really fantastic. I can't wait. 2034 is so far away, though. I wish it was sooner.
Yeah, it's crazy you guys are that far out. You said something a second ago that I want to get at. You were talking about like what constitutes a life, and I think that's such an interesting, That must just be like a daily question for you, but like for me, that's an interesting question, because you know, like what is life? Like, is a germ a life? You know, is it how do you really define that? And like in your job, like where does that begin and where does it end?
Oh man, yeah, it's a really hard question. This is something like scientists, we study this our entire lives, and it's still a hard question, right? I mean, some people may define life as sort of simply something that eats, so it consumes, maybe it poops and reproduces, right? Well, if by that definition, fire is alive, right? Because it consumes oxygen, it produces like carbon waste, and it can reproduce. You can make more fire from fire.
Wow.
So that doesn't, and then by that similar definition, something like a mule, which is sterile, but obviously alive, but that wouldn't be alive because it can't reproduce, right? And then there are things like viruses that can't reproduce on their own. They need like another organism to kind of go in and make copies of themselves. So just based on our simple definitions of life, that we come up with, the things that we know to be alive don't really fit. So we're working on trying to come up with ways that are more agnostic, so less Earth life-centric when we go and look out in the universe. So when we do, hopefully, find life somewhere else, which I think we will, we don't want to miss it, right? Because our definition is too strict or something like that.
Do you think that, so I read a book recently about Titan, and Titan's the coolest place in our solar system probably, and this is why you have like a flying mission, because it's the easiest place to fly. Humans could strap on wings and fly like a bird, and you could safely skydive with it a parachute because the terminal velocity is 15 miles per hour, and you could build like super easy airships and stuff like that. Do you think Titan with its, it's super cold though, it's colder than liquid nitrogen. Do you think that Titan could, there could be some kind of life, because it does have liquid, right? It has liquid hydrocarbons. Lakes, the only place that has liquids other than Earth.
Correct, except for one minor thing, if you don't mind me correcting you. It's actually a little bit warmer than liquid nitrogen. So liquid nitrogen is, it is liquid about 77 Kelvin, which, so I'm a scientist. I don't work in Fahrenheit, but it's really cold. It's minus 196 degrees Celsius. And that's really cold, but Titan is a little bit warmer than that, which is important because oxygen liquefies at 90 Kelvin, which is right about where, or 85, something like that. But anyway, so Titan's surface is 90 Kelvin, and it turns out to be, it could be actually suitable for, well, not suitable for Earth life, but like if you were a person standing on the surface of Titan, like you said, the atmosphere is thicker. It's about 1.5 times the pressure of here. So it'd be like if you held your breath and went to the deep end of your swimming pool, that's about the pressure you would feel. And the gravity is a lot less. It's about 1/7 that of Earth's gravity. It's kind of like what the astronauts experienced on the moon, the Apollo astronauts. So yeah, if you were standing on the surface of Titan and you had wings and you flapped them, you could fly. That's why we're going to be flying with Dragonfly. It's actually more efficient than driving in this environment. But yeah, it's cold enough that if you were a human standing there, you would need one heck of a parka. Like you couldn't have any exposed skin. Yeah. You could have, if you brought your own oxygen with you, there's not much oxygen in Titan's atmosphere. It's mostly nitrogen with about 4% methane. So you need to bring your oxygen with you. But then, you know, you could have it strapped to your body somewhere. And since it's above the point where it's liquid, it would still be a gas and you could breathe it in. So astronauts could walk around on the surface of Titan without too much issue. You wouldn't need the giant spacesuit. Now, when it comes to life, yeah, it's a little bit challenging to think about what kind of life might exist on the surface of Titan. It is really cold. Most chemical reactions, as a chemist, I'm interested in that. Most chemical reactions either slow down or stop completely when you cool things down. And so that could be a challenge. But then again, life could take on some forms where maybe timescales don't matter as much. Maybe the chemistry could happen over hundreds of years for us, but that would be a normal life cycle for something that existed in one of those methane lakes of Titan. We don't really know. And something we can study in the lab, and we're doing a little bit of that. I've been making little mini Titan lakes in the lab for a few years now, and we're dissolving molecules in those and trying to see what kind of chemistry is possible. And we're already discovering some things that really surprise us. We found a bunch of molecules that will form structures together. We call them molecular minerals because they sort of take the place of like rocks here on Earth, but they're made out of weird organic molecules, hazardous stuff like hydrogen cyanide or benzene, things like that. So I think when it comes to a place like Titan, at least on the surface, we're making discoveries every day that are kind of changing our perceptions of what could be possible for chemistry and potentially biochemistry for life.
Yeah, I wonder, what do you think is like the jackpot discovery for someone in your role at NASA? I mean, obviously, like aliens would be really cool, but like, but what's the drive for this research, and like, what do you guys, I mean, obviously you're just hoping to collect data and stuff, I assume, but what's the hope on a daily basis?
Well, all of us, I mean, space is one of the last frontiers, right, for exploration. It's one of those places where you can send something somewhere and you can have the best idea of what you expect to find and be completely wrong. And I love that. There are so few fields these days as a scientist where you can, I think, go in and just be completely surprised. And it doesn't even have to necessarily be the search for life. We are finding out wacky things about like how Venus's atmosphere got the way it is, why Mars lost most of its atmosphere. Every time we send a spacecraft to one of these worlds and we look, we get so surprised, and it helps us reshape and fix and update our models for, say, how the whole solar system formed, how we got here. It can also help change our ideas of where we might search for life or other habitable environments, other Earths in the universe. Because at some points, our Earth is not going to be habitable for us anymore. Our sun is expanding. And granted, this is going to take a few billion years. So, you know, we won't be around, but maybe our kids, you know, for a while.
Yeah. We spend the rest of the podcast saying kids.
Yeah, right. The sun's going to expand out, and eventually things are going to get way too hot for water to exist on Earth anymore. And I'm hoping, well before that happens, that we will be an interstellar species and we will have found other places that we can send people to live. And part of that goal is to find those environments and send some exploratory spacecraft there. It's kind of cool. Right now, we can't send astronauts to Titan yet. Maybe in a decade or two, we'll be there. But since I can't go there myself, sending these spacecraft there to extend my own senses, right? We have instruments that will tell us what Titan basically tastes and smells like, what it sounds like. We're going to have some microphones on Dragonfly that'll tell us what the wind sounds like. These things can help, even though I can't go there myself. It'll make it, it's as close as I can get to being there.
That is so cool.
My understanding is that there, you know, we could imagine life that's different from Earth life, but there may not be much reason. Like, there is a reason why Earth life is carbon-based, let's say, instead of silica-based, right? Which is another possibility, silicon-based, which is another possibility. But, you know, silicon forms, like, solid blocks, and it's hard to expire that out, and it's just less in, there's less concentrations of it, and I guess the four bonded structures are not as easy to form. So, you know, like silicon life, like they had in Star Trek, that, you know, cave dweller that made solid blocks or I guess spheres or whatever. Maybe that's not really, maybe somewhere out there there's some of that, but it's really just not the most logical way to kind of construct life if you were thinking about it. So do we have any ideas about some actual models of how life could be significantly different from our, you know, DNA and proteins and carbon-based structure and all this? Because, yeah, it just seems like almost if you try to assemble life, and I think the leading hypothesis might be like RNA, started with like RNA chains or something like that, and then eventually kind of, and those can reproduce themselves and then eventually form proteins for more specialized tasks and eventually evolved into DNA. But is there any other way you could imagine life actually forming?
That is a really good question.
And really long question.
Yes.
No, I'm lost.
That's okay.
I'm glad you understood it.
I did. And I will do my best to try to answer it. So yeah, there are some very unique reasons why life, at least as I understand it, on our planet chose carbon as its main element for forming all of the molecular machinery that gets us to be alive, right? Carbon is really good at forming bonds that are strong enough to hang around in most of our conditions, but not so strong you can't break them later, which you may need. For example, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, is our energy-carrying molecule. Every form of life uses it. All of them. And the way that it moves energy around is with a phosphate bond. So a phosphorus connected to an oxygen. And that covalent bond is, it's robust enough that you can pass this sort of molecule around without it degrading on you. But then when you need that energy, you just crack that bond open and now you've got a bunch of energy that you can use for staying alive. So I think that life picked carbon, phosphorus, oxygen, these elements, because they have that unique chemistry, but also because they're really abundant. I love talking about this stuff, like how you, most of the atoms in your body were actually formed either in the fusion nuclei of stars or in these binary neutron star, like mass collision explosion things. Everything except the hydrogen and helium. And so if you look at like how abundant stuff is, carbon, nitrogen, all of the stuff that's in our bodies is really common in the universe. And so, of course, it makes sense that life would use what's around. So yeah, it uses these common elements and it uses them in unique combinations. But we can envision in the lab, and some people have made molecules that are like those but different. that maybe if life had gone off on a different tangent, it could have used those instead of the ones we use today. And let me give a simple example. All amino acids in our bodies, those make up our proteins, they are all left-handed. They exist as potential mirror images of each other, and all life just happened to pick one kind that it uses. This influences how proteins fold and how it is able to do a lot of chemistry in our bodies that keeps us alive. And it just so happened to pick the left-hand form. It could have just as easily picked the right. And we can make right-handed amino acids in the lab. You can make right-handed proteins out of those. But if you try to use those for life, it's not going to work.
What do you mean by left-handed versus right-handed protein? You're talking about proteins that are ambidextrous, potentially?
Yeah, we can try to make them, but it'd be like if you were trying to shake someone's hand with your right hand and you tried to shake their one. And, you know, you have to, like, twist around and do this.
Mirror image, basically. Think of a mirror image. So it's not the same as the original.
And it basically takes two of these together to build the kind of structure you're talking about.
Yeah, so life needs molecules to interact with each other, to grab on, maybe swap some molecules or do some chemistry. That's how we stay alive. And if they don't fold in the proper way to, say, wrap around a magnesium ion, for example, that you use in an enzyme, then your protein isn't going to work and you'll end up not being able to metabolize stuff. So it just so happened that we use the left-handed ones. But it's, you know what's weird? When it comes to sugars, we use the right-handed sugars. No one knows why. It's kind of weird. We're all just like, this is strange, but we're all alive, so I guess this works. That's actually how a lot of diet sodas work, is they give you the opposite, the left-handed sugar, which your body can't digest. It doesn't bind the same way.
It can't digest it? It's probably worse for you.
I mean, you can still break it down, but it doesn't cause like the same... You don't metabolize it in the same way as you do normal sugars.
Interesting.
Which one is the isomer?
It's like reversed sugar.
Which diet? Because I thought there was one sugar that was like an isomer or something, a different left-handed version of the right-handed sugar. Or is there just one specific one, or is there multiple?
D versus L glucose or D versus L fructose. D is the left-handed, D is the right-handed. L is the left-handed. It goes back to Greek, the dextrorotatory.
But what brand? I mean, is it a specific brand or type that is an isomer, or are they all like that?
All of them have. Anything that has a carbon that's bonded to four different things will have what we call an enantiomer, which is like an isomer. It's the mirror image. So same mass, same charge, but you can't shake the same hand because it's the mirror image of it. So it's weird.
Well, what type of fake sugar does that?
I don't recall the name of it.
Stevia.
I could look it up. It's one of those. But the point is that life could just as easily has gone down a different path. Still used almost the same molecular machinery we use, but still would be incompatible with our life. And so that's one example. But there are plenty of scientists who are working in the lab to make completely alien forms of some of our molecules. For example, DNA. DNA is what stores all of our information in our cells. And it's the blueprints, the instructions for how to make us, right? Well, DNA... works really well in liquid water, but what if you're trying to find life that existed, say, in a Titan lake that has liquid methane as its liquid? Methane is very different from water. Water is a polar solvent. Methane is the opposite. It's nonpolar. Now, if you remember from basic chemistry, like dissolves like.
I remember nothing from basic chemistry.
Basic or acidic? Oh, chemistry joke. I'm terrible. All right. But yeah, it'd be like dissolving oil in water to try to get DNA to dissolve in liquid methane. So instead, some of our colleagues are trying to come up with other long molecules. They've got to be big, right, so they can contain information that could still dissolve in one of those liquids. And it's a challenging problem, but they're working on it. And who knows, they may come up with something that's totally randomly alien, but still able to do the same sort of functions that life as we know it would need to survive.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise.
Now, what do you think about panspermia? Or do you think that life, if it is to be found in other worlds, do you think it would have originated there? How difficult do you think the hurdle is of life initiating in the first place versus the hurdle of life traversing some barrier from, you know, simple like RNA chains or something like that to actual amino acids and proteins and more complex life and eventually getting to like a cell wall or, you know, what's kind of the major hurdle in your view And do you think that panspermia maybe happened in some places or explains most life or probably didn't happen?
Panspermia, for those of you who aren't familiar with the term, is a description of how, let's say, life started on Earth, and then through various meteoritic impacts that were able to eject stuff up where cells or life could still be intact, that those then went and contaminated another world, basically seeded it with Earth life. That's what panspermia is. So we know that meteoritic impacts can end up producing projectiles from a world where the interior of that wouldn't get much higher than room temperature, not just from the impact, but if it, say, had to go through another atmosphere to land somewhere else. So we know that it's possible that microbial hitchhikers could survive that kind of a journey. And we do know over geologic time, the time that the solar system has been around, that the planets have been swapping spit with each other for billions of years. Like, it's just, that's happened. There hasn't been a lot of material, though, very far out. Like, Earth hasn't exchanged that much with, say, Jupiter's moon Europa. And so, from my perspective, it would be challenging if something were to, say, hit on this icy exterior of one of these moons. That's great. You could have life that manages to get to the surface, but the liquid water is a few kilometers down through ice, right? And so unless there's an active way to sort of grab that stuff and pull it down into that water, that might be a bit more challenging to believe that that could have happened. It's still possible. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it starts to push the bounds of what I think is just probabilistically statistically possible, let's say.
I don't know. Maybe somebody wound up there with a jackhammer or something.
No, it is possible. And we know, for example, Europa's surface is only about 50 million years old, which sounds old, but it's like super, super
young
old compared to a lot of places in the solar system. And so that means that the surface is being refreshed on pretty short timescales. So it's possible that something landed on the surface, got sucked down in, and then is growing in Europa's ocean, which is three times bigger than all of Earth's oceans combined. It's a lot of water. But we also know that chances are Earth life may have started on Earth a bunch of different times. We know that life has undergone, what, 6 or 7 major extinction events on Earth alone. And so I don't think it's impossible that the conditions could be right for life to start on its own in some of these other worlds. I'll give you an example. Another moon around Saturn is called Enceladus. This one, it's similar to Europa. It's got a rocky core, a liquid water ocean, and then a crust of ice on the outside. Except this crust of ice has 4 big cracks in it. We call them the tiger stripes because it looks like a tiger went like that. And out of those tiger stripes is coming free sample from its liquid water ocean. And Cassini was in the Saturn system for 13 years, and it flew through that plume of material and basically stuck its tongue out and detected a bunch of different organic molecules, not just little ones, but big ones. It also found methane and hydrogen at concentrations that tell us that that liquid water ocean is in contact with the inside, the rocky core, at temperatures of almost the boiling point of water or above. And so that tells me that there's hydrothermal interactions going on. And any place that we find hydrothermal interactions on Earth, like at the seafloor, where you've got liquid water interacting with our heated interior, we find rich communities of life that are living as far removed from sunlight and other stuff as possible. And there are many scientists who think that's where life originated here on Earth. It has all the conditions. It has these chimneys that come out where there are some dimensions of some of the pores, the pockets in those chimneys are exactly the same size as some of our primordial cells. There are minerals in those like McKinnawite and Greggite, these iron sulfur clusters that you could take that cluster and take a protein that has those same things in it, and it's almost exactly the same structure. It's really eerie, some of the similarities. So it's really possible that life could have originated in some of these hydrothermal vents. And we think they're present on Enceladus. We've got some strong evidence there. They're probably present on Europa, too. A lot of these places that have liquid water and rock that are in contact with each other. So I think it's more likely that we could find a separate genesis of life in one or multiple places than panspermia. But that's just my opinion. There are lots of scientists who I'm sure have other wider opinions about this.
What do you think of the idea that there's been like multiple iterations of humans on Earth? Like this, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the theory that like recently archaeologists found like 11, it was between like 10 or 11 layers of buildings beneath the Indus River Valley civilizations. And they don't know if it was like from like multiple timelines of humanity or if it was just like, you know, some like giant dungeon that was built for some reason. Have you heard of this? Do you have any opinions on this?
Wow, that's amazing. Well, I mean, it's hard enough for us to be able to track back to early Earth in the geologic record because a lot of those rocks are changed to such an extent that we can't figure out what their original composition was. And the same is with trying to look for some of these ancient human civilizations, right? If it's not old enough to have been fossilized, some of that record might have been lost. So that's really fascinating.
So do you believe that there's extraterrestrial civilizations in our own galaxy?
You just took my question.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, what would they be like? Do you imagine that because of convergent evolution, they might actually be somehow humanoid or something, even though they've evolved separately, like sharks and dolphins are superficially similar, even though they're very different? Or is it completely bogus and we should expect octopods and green lizard people, or not even people?
I have no idea. I mean, and you brought up some really great examples, right? Like the octopus has really distinct symmetry compared to our sort of, you know, bimodal or whatever, our just twin symmetry that most organisms, advanced organisms now have. I don't want to make any assumptions about any kind of life we might find. Just based on the diversity of planetary systems we're seeing, it could vary widely, right? We're finding these things called super Earths that are, you know, 10 times more massive than our Earth, so a lot stronger gravity. But we're finding those are pretty common planets around other stars. We're finding things like hot Jupiters, which are basically like Jupiter, but way closer to the star. And around our own Jupiter, places like Europa that have liquid water and could have conditions for life. So what if that was closer to the star? Could that still survive? Maybe there'd be like Endor.
Andorians.
Yeah.
Andorians live on an icy moon of gas giant from Star Trek. Yeah.
There could be anything. Space is so big. And what is that quote from Contact, the Carl Sagan book, is, boy, if we're the only thing out here, it seems like an awful waste of space.
Yeah, but the universe doesn't care about wasting space because it already does. There's a lot of space out there.
Yeah, but there are some theories that we're kind of late to the game, right? The universe has been around for almost 15 billion years. And so life could have started, blossomed, originated in a bunch of different places and either died out or now, since the universe is expanding, maybe they're so far away that we'll never communicate with them. And so we may just be sort of the new kids on the block and really late to the party, and everybody else is like, yep, we're way over here now.
That's the Babylon 5 theory.
What do you think of UFOs?
Oh, man. Well, as a scientist, I focus on data, right?
Okay. That's what I thought you'd say.
Well, I mean, there are some compelling videos that people have taken, but nowadays with everyone and their cell phones,
yeah.
I'm kind of like, if there was something, you think we would have a lot of different pieces of evidence from a lot of different people to substantiate something. Now, there are certainly things that have yet to be explained by science, and we're hopefully going to get better at learning about those things and explaining them later on. That's what I love about science. It's like, you know, we have what's in the books, the science books, and then we have the things that scientists like me get to do, which is not in the books yet, because we're discovering it right now. And then later, maybe some of the things I do in the lab will be in a science book. And so maybe some of these weird phenomena that people see will be documented one day and explained. There's all sorts of random stuff like heat lightning and things that we didn't understand a few years ago that now we're getting a much better handle on. And I think it would be really cool to finally realize that, you know, alien life exists and maybe it's trying to contact us. But I think that if it were, it would probably try to...
It probably would have already done it, yeah.
Yeah, or at least it would be something that would be much more obvious and not something that could be dismissed or debated. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to sound like I'm fighting for UFO conspiracy theories here, and I'm not, but I just find this interesting, and I want to hear what you're going to say to it. what's interesting to me about these UFO stories that you hear is that they all seem to be concentrated in certain specific areas. Like Roswell, New Mexico is one. There's another one in Florida somewhere. I don't know where. And then there's like a couple of hot spots in Europe or people like, you know, just like Roswell, New Mexico. And if there was, just theoretically speaking, if there was some interdimensional creature traveling to and from the third dimension, it would do it through a fold, which would be in a specific geographical place. And it would be arguably concentrated, right?
I don't know. I mean, the Earth is moving through space, right? We're orbiting around the sun. Our whole solar system is also moving through space, right? Mm-hmm. So if there was some sort of space-time fold or something, I think it would be weird to show up in the same place, because then they would have to have...
Because it's not the same place, yeah.
You're saying the fold would move? Theoretically speaking, obviously.
Well, no, I think the fold would stay in the same place, but because Earth and the sun and everything are moving...
But if space-time is one thing, then maybe they're locked.
Maybe. I don't know.
We are getting real weird here.
Sounds far-fetched.
It really blows the mind to think about, for sure.
I think it's confirmation bias. The reason they all happen in the same place is because people think they may find them. So people wandering around New Mexico think, hey, maybe there's aliens. Oh, look, there's a light in the sky that they don't understand.
I think that's it.
Therefore, aliens.
I think that's it.
And they don't feel as crazy reporting it, too.
That is a good point. But we also find on Earth... there are very particular conditions that only exist in certain kind of ecological niches, right? Where the earth, the sun angle is just right, or the humidity is just right, where maybe one kind of plant only exists in a certain spot. And so it could just be that if this is some sort of atmospheric phenomenon or something like that, it happens in one place because those conditions tend to be just right for that to exist there. It's possible.
Like a mirage or something like that, the air wafting over the desert.
Yeah.
Do you listen to a lot of podcasts, Morgan?
I listen to some.
Do you listen to Joe Rogan?
Yeah, I do. A little bit.
There's an episode that came out like 2 weeks ago, I think. My cousin actually told me to check it out before I had this conversation with you, and I failed him. I did not listen to it. But he had some UFO person on, someone from the Navy who allegedly saw a UFO. And apparently, did you hear that one?
No, I didn't hear that one.
I was just curious. He's like a lawyer, like hard facts kind of guy. He's like, I believe in UFOs after this podcast episode.
We always like to test things multiple times, right? If I see something in the lab once, that's great. But if I can't reproduce it, it doesn't matter. In fact, there's a journal called the Journal of Irreproducible Results, where if you saw something weird happen one time, you can write a little paper and stick it in there. But it's kind of a joke, right? Like, as scientists, if it's not something you can create more than once and reproduce and understand, then, you know, it's a fluke. And it can get frustrating sometimes, but I think it makes our conclusions and our theories a lot more robust when we study things that way.
In physics, like de Broglie, you can sometimes put your finger through a wall or something like that, but it's like, basically it's just a probabilistic thing, which could never like actually happen just because there's so many probabilities involved. But yeah, weird things happen, right?
Yeah, it's it's a non-zero probability.
Yeah, non-zero. Yeah. pretty damn close to zero. Yeah.
Exactly.
Morgan, I'm curious where you, we kind of touched on this earlier, but I want to dial it in even further. We were talking about what constitutes a life, and I'm curious how someone in your line of work defines intelligent life versus other types of life. Because obviously, there's pretty much any animal has instincts and, you know, survival mechanisms and things like that. So where do you guys draw the line?
Ooh, that is a really good question. And I should preface this with that I personally don't look for intelligent life. Most of the tests that we design are
you look for stupid life.
Small cells and stuff like that. But I could imagine if I were looking for intelligent life, it would have to be able to communicate in some way where it was so different from kind of an abiotic scenario. Like, for example, some stars will give off these complex radio bursts. And it's something that's sort of weird, but it's not something where if we were to send a signal that it would respond in any way. It's just sort of a cyclic kind of periodic emission that happens. And so we would need to find a way to filter those out. It would also be interesting, though, to think of if this alien life were to operate on the same timescales as us. And I know a lot of sci-fi shows have explored this, where maybe an alien civilization is born, you know, reaches its height and dies in a few milliseconds. Like, how do you how do you talk to something like that where we couldn't even respond on a timescale that would make sense to them?
Don't even have time to say hi.
It's like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There's this fleet of this race, and they've been at war or something like that. And they build this giant battle fleet, and they think they're going to go and conquer the other civilization. And then they end up just getting like eaten by the cat or something because they're actually super, super tiny. They're like little tiny things, and they're fighting these giants, and they didn't even get noticed. And their whole battle fleet is consumed by the cat.
Yeah. So what an ending. Entirely possible. I think we need to. And SETI has done such a great job of like trying to maintain an open mind when it comes to looking for things like that. And I do think sci-fi is a great place to explore all of the possible things that could exist and help us be creative and come up with ways of how we might test those kinds of theories. Because I think ultimately we'll end up doing something contact-like where using the universal language of math or physics or something where we all have to follow those same rules, right? As independent of language, as independent of the star you're in orbit around or anything like that. But the speed of light is still going to be something that's going to be the same, at least in our observable universe, except if you're near a black hole, and then all rules are off. But other than that, you know, so maybe we can communicate through some of those basic fundamental things of physics, those laws that are going to be the same.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. Andrew, do you have anything you want to ask before we start winding this down?
No, that's good.
Morgan, do you have anything else you want to talk about that we didn't touch on?
Yeah, there's one thing. So I became a scientist partly because of my dad, who was also a scientist, partly because I had some really amazing teachers, and partly because I had these questions growing up where, like, I would ask a question and I couldn't find an answer and realize that no one had the answer yet, and I would have to go, or someone would have to go and figure it out. And I think it's important to keep in mind that scientists come from, you know, little kids who are curious and who end up realizing they can do that for a living. And so if anyone listening out there is curious or likes to take things apart and maybe put them back together, like science and engineering are some really, you can have a career that's super rewarding and is a lot of fun. And so don't stop asking questions and trying to figure out what the answers are.
I love that.
Actually, I do have one more thing. Can you tell us about mountain unicycling?
Oh, yes. Okay. So I do this weird sport. It's called mountain unicycling, or Muni for short.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. We basically just took all the parts of the mountain bike you don't need, you know, the brakes,
the extra wheel,
the gears, the training wheel. And we just got rid of all that.
Training wheel.
It's actually a lot of fun. It's the one thing where I can't be thinking about anything else while I'm doing it. Like, you have to be totally focused.
It's forced forced concentration.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of like meditation in motion, right? If I let my mind drift off to like all the things that I still have to do in the lab or the paper I'm working on or something.
You're dead.
Right? Yeah. And so I think it's important to have balance in your life. And that means exercise, hobby, like stuff that you can focus on that sort of takes you away from your day to day. And for me, that's what that is.
Well, this has been an awesome chat. Thank you so much for making the time. Is there anything you want to plug before we jump off?
Oh, yeah. So I'm at Stars Are Calling because the stars are calling and we must go. And I just make sure that you pay attention to any news related to like Dragonfly or this Europa Clipper mission that we're working on that's going to launch in about 4 or 5 years that's going to explore Jupiter's moon Europa. There's a lot of cool stuff NASA is doing for trying to understand the universe and our place in it and where life could exist. So stay tuned and stay curious.
I love that. Stay curious. Thank you guys for listening. We hope you enjoyed this. If you want to follow Andrew and I, I'm at Julian Was Here on Twitter. Andrew is at Mars Raider, and we do these episodes every Monday. Hope to have you back next week.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.